This is November 18th, 2007, and this will be the second in a series of three teishos relating to the precepts as our annual Jukai ceremony approaches. It'll be in 6 days, actually Great Jukai this time. The first of these three teishos was done by Amala Sensei. On last week, I think, on the first precept, emphasizing how the first precept, not to kill but to cherish all life, how that relates to global warming. Today's will be a more general look at the underpinnings of morality in Buddhism. And then the third one will be this Saturday, the day of the morning of Jukai, and we'll do a more general review of the different aspects of the precepts and morality. Today I'm going to use a koan to try to investigate the matter of karma as it relates to morality and the our actions and the consequences of our actions. This is a very famous one from the Mumon Kan, the Gateless Barrier. This is probably the most famous koan from the most famous collection of koans, and it's number two, Hyakujo and a Fox. So first, I'll read the. For those of you who don't know, each of these koans has first the main case, which is based on a story or a dialogue from ancient China or India, and then there is a commentary and a verse by Zen Master Mumon, who compiled this collection of koans, hence the word Mumon Kan. So here's the case. Whenever Hyakujo delivered a teisho, a certain old man was always there listening to it together with the monks, and when they left the hall, he left also. One day, however, he remained behind, and Hyakujo said to him, "Who may you be?" The old man replied, "I am not a human being. In the far distant past, in the time of Kashyapa Buddha, I was the head of this monastery. On one occasion, a certain monk asked me whether an enlightened man could fall again under the chain of cause and effect, and I answered that he could not. Because of this answer, I have for 500 lives been reborn a fox. I now beg you to release me from this fox body by saying the turning words on my behalf." Then he asked Hyakujo, "Can an enlightened man fall again under the chain of cause and effect or not?" Hyakujo answered, "He does not ignore the law of causation." And at that, the old man immediately awakened, and he made his bows and said, "I am now released from rebirth as a fox, and my body will be found on the other side of this mountain. I wish to make a request of you. Please bury me as a dead monk." Hyakujo had the head monk strike the clappers and inform the monks that after the midday meal, there would be a funeral service for a dead monk. The monks thought this odd, since all were in good health. There was no sick monk in the Nirvana Hall. That was the name for the infirmary, and they wondered what the reason could be for this order. After they had eaten, Hyakujo led them to the foot of a rock on the far side of the mountain, and with his staff poked out the dead body of a fox and had it cremated. There's also I think, the longest koan in the Mumon Kan. We're not done yet. Still on the case. In the evening, Hyakujo ascended the rostrum in the hall and told the monks the whole story. Obaku thereupon asked the following question. This old man made a mistake in his answer and suffered rebirth as a fox for 500 lives, you say. But suppose every time that he answered, he had not made a mistake. What would he have become? Hyakujo replied, just come closer to me and I'll tell you. Obaku then went up to Hyakujo and slapped him. Hyakujo, clapping his hands and laughing, exclaimed, I thought that the barbarian's beard is red, but I see that you are a barbarian with a red beard. And that's the end of the case. We'll save the commentary and verse until later. We don't have time today to get into any biographical material on these two great Chinese masters. Actually, I've been reading the Japanese versions of their name. Hyakujo, the present abbot in this case, was the great Baijong Weihai. And then later, Obaku was his famous Dharma heir, Huang Bo. So we'll forego any material on these two guys and just sort of wade into this case. Now, this is a classic example of how koans are not always based on actual events. This, of course, is a kind of a fable. Some of the koans are like that. They take some old story from ancient times and use it as a way to for one to investigate the nature of reality, one's understanding of the truth. In this case, it addresses the cornerstone of Buddhist morality, which is karma. And karma, it's one of these words that has wormed its way into the English language. It was 10 years ago that I first saw it myself. In the New York Times, an article in the New York Times with no definition, so it's becoming better known, although still I suspect widely misunderstood. There are still people who think that karma means fate. When you say it's my karma, it's a kind of in some people's minds it's this resigned attitude toward this force that one can do nothing about. It's just my destiny. It's my fate. It's out of my hands. And that, as most of you know, is a complete misunderstanding of karma. Because if karma means anything, it means that we are reworking it all the time. We are changing it. It's a dynamic phenomenon that we can work with and change. I'm going to go back to one of the very first books on Buddhism in English. And this is called The Three Jewels, and it's by a monk by the name of Sangharaksha, an English monk, actually, who launched his practice in India, and then after some years of deep study in India, he went back to his native England, and there founded what is not still the most, the biggest, most prominent Buddhist organization in England, called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order (FWBO), which has satellites all over. In many countries in the world. It's not Zen. It's a more a kind of a general. It's not Zen. It's not Tibetan Buddhism. It's more kind of an Indian flavored Buddhism, more general kind, that has a lot of emphasis on study and scholasticism. But if it's clarification on Buddhist doctrine that you want, there are few people, few English native English speakers, who can do a better job of outlining it than this Bhikshu Sangharakshita. I'm turning to chapter 10 in this book, The Three Jewels, and we'll just outline some key points about karma, some of which are so widely misunderstood. The literal meaning of karma is action, but it also implies the result of action. But to equate it with causation is a misunderstanding that I, until recently, have been guilty of myself. Karma is one kind of causation. And above all, karma is based on intention. Buddhism has been called a religion of intention. It is our intention or our volition, our will, that determines our karma. And our karma then is what creates our momentum in terms of our habit forces, our psychology, our tendencies or dispositions, which are all important in spiritual practice, because those are the things we have confronting us every day, our basic tendencies. They're sometimes called formations, mental formations. But it all begins with the will, the intention. I'll just read some of this. This will be the best way of doing this in a clear, organized way. This karma, by the way, is an enormously complex and not probably not understood thoroughly by anyone as a doctrine. He says here, Buddhism maintains that involuntary actions do not constitute karma, and therefore cannot bring about the results accruing to karma. This doesn't mean that such actions produce no results at all. The unintentional dropping of a brick on our own toes hurts no less than if we had done it deliberately. It only means that unwilled actions do not modify character. That's a really key point. Unwilled actions do not modify character. Character being what I just said, these habit forces of mind, our basic dispositions. Karma is only one particular type of cause-effect relation. The Buddha repeatedly condemned the doctrine of fatalism. And he taught that though he teaches that every willed action produces an experienced effect, he does not teach that all experienced effects are products of willed action or karma. And then Sangharakshita here lists five different orders of cause and effect. One is that of physical inorganic order. Then there's the physical organic or biological order. and there's the mental order, then there's volitional order, that's what we were talking about with karma, and then there's what's called transcendental order. We don't have time to break all those down, but just to make the point that karma is just one kind of cause and effect. Well, I'll just give an example of those five, how they relate to one another. Someone is suffering from fever. The complaint may be due to a sudden change of temperature, that's the physical inorganic order, to the presence of a germ, that's the biological, to mental strain or worry, that's the mental, or to tension due to experiences taking place in the dhyanas, in the mind. And then to the fact that in a previous life he had harmed someone, and so forth. And then skipping some of this, because we don't have the time, he outlines seven different types of karma. And they're classified or grouped according to these seven categories. Their ethical status, the door through which they act, that means body, speech, or mind, the appropriateness of the resultant experiences, their time and relative priority of taking effect, the nature of their function, and the plane of existence on which they mature. I won't try to do all of these, but just the first few. The first way of categorizing or classifying karma is on the basis of the ethical status or quality, or that is the whether an act of will, an intention, is wholesome or unwholesome. These words are more Buddhistic than good or bad, or right and wrong, or good and evil. Unwholesome volition or intention is that which is rooted in greed, anger, and delusion. These are the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion. And wholesome volition is that's rooted in the opposite of these passions. That's the key thing. And then the second way of classifying is the door, whether these types of volition, the wholesome or unwholesome, can act directly through the mind or indirectly through the body or speech. And then here is where things tighten up in the way of karma, and that is that one will reap the consequences not only of what he has intentionally said and done, but also of what he has deliberately thought or allowed himself to think, even without giving it expression in word or deed. Now, it doesn't mean that if it just remains on the level of thought, that it has the same karmic consequences as when it's in words or in action, but it still is consequences. And this is where meditation becomes central in our practice, is because it is only through meditation that we can redirect these mental habit forces or purify these mental habit forces. And it is key, because so much of what we say and do arises from our thoughts. Then he points out that volitions admit of different degrees of intensity. A volition or intention that comes out in word or deed is generally stronger than one that doesn't. And a strong will obviously produces greater results than a weak will. But whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, a mindset of a degree of intensity that results in word or deed or both will, even if it's denied overt vocal or bodily expression, bring about the same pleasant or painful experiences that the actual performance of the deed would have done. So then he mentions this this famous story, Zen story, about the two monks who reach the edge of a river that they need to cross, and they see a damsel in distress there who can't forge across the river, and without hesitating, one of the monks just sweeps her up in his arms and just carries her across, sets her down at the other edge of the river, and then goes on. The younger monk is in a tizzy about this because in the strict monastic regulations, monks weren't allowed to touch, put a finger on a woman. And they go on for a while, and the young monk is just in a mental turmoil over this. How could he have done this? How could he have done this? He's violated his vows. He's da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And finally, he just blurts out this, how could you have done that? It's against all of our rules. And the more senior monk says, are you still carrying that woman? I set her down back at the edge of the river. It speaks to the very the key point in all of Zen is how we want to avoid clinging to thoughts. Not avoid thinking. That's different. Thinking is something we need to do. We may need to do it often. When confronted with a difficult problem that we need to solve, figure out. Buddhism has no quarrel. Zen has no quarrel with thinking. It's just chewing over thoughts unnecessarily, dwelling in thoughts of past or future unnecessarily. This is where we just diminish our experience of life because we're not present. We're split. We're somewhere else. So, in conclusion, then, regarding this matter of intention, that our words and actions are wholesome or unwholesome, not in themselves, but according to whether they are the expression of wholesome or of unwholesome volitions. The third classification of karma is that according to the appropriateness of the resultant experiences. And this is the idea that the Buddha supposedly said that those who are given to the taking of life, cruelty, anger, envy, greed, pride, will be reborn in states of suffering, or will be short-lived, diseased, ugly, despised, poor, and those whose acts of body, speech, and mind are rooted in healthy attitudes will be reborn in the higher planes of existence, or if they're born as humans, will be long-lived, healthy, handsome, respected, wealthy, and so forth. But now, here, again, because karma is not the only kind of cause and effect, this can be carried too far. And I think it often is by people who are new to practice. They tend to make equivalences that are too simple, Okay, I got a cold, so I got a cold, so I must have caused someone else, or I had identity theft occur to me, so that means I must have caused, I'm guilty of theft myself in a past life. Well, maybe. We don't know. It's a waste of time to try to ruminate about some previous cause. I think it's enough if we can simply have faith that when injustice is done to us, it's not just something gone awry in the universe. It's not an accident. Then we don't have to go about trying to pinpoint or think about what we may have done earlier in this lifetime or some previous lifetime. According to the text, we've done it all. So it would be to pervert the Buddhist teaching to argue that poverty is always the punishment for bad and riches are always the reward of good karma performed in past lives. The next two classifications are with regard to time and relative priority of effect. With regard to time, karma may ripen in the same life in which it was performed, in the next life, in a succeeding life, or, owing to the preponderance of counteractive karma, or to its being too weak, it may never ripen. Those of you who are hearing your first or second Teisho, let me just say that it's unusual. For there to be this much doctrine to be for me to go through all this in Teisho, but I felt that especially with this period of examination of the precepts, that it's worth going into this doctrine of karma that is so so complex and so easily misunderstood. And then the classification according to priority of effect refers not to the effects of karma in general, but only to one kind of effect, that which we call rebirth. From this point of view, karmas are classified as weighty, death proximate, habitual, and residual. The dhyanas are, that means the states of meditation, good, healthy meditation, are considered healthy, weighty volitions. And then matricide, parricide, killing an arhat, wounding a Buddha, creating a schism in the Sangha are considered unhealthy, weighty volitions. Death proximate karma is the volition occurring immediately before death, which may be the reflex of some previously performed karma or of something connected with it. The formula that I've often repeated, having read it many times, is that rebirth takes place with all of the thoughts, words, and actions of your life, or of your past, not just one life, all of the collective thoughts, words, and actions as the basis, and with the last thought at the moment of death as the governing principle. So it's this combination of everything we have done and said and thought since time immemorial, that all that and the that final second or half second as we slip into death. And you see the connection between these two. If you've led a dissolute life or lives where you are giving way, falling prey to greed, ill will, confusion or delusion, if you've done that your whole life, not to mention more than one life, then it's going to be nearly impossible on your deathbed to jerk yourself out of those tendencies and slip into this intermediate state with a mind, a pure and clear mind. So that's the death proximate karma, the one that's supposed to be the governing cause. Habitual karma is one that's repeatedly performed. Here's some good news for all of us who are practicing. Authorities on the Abhidharma. The Abhidharma is the whole vast canon of texts, Buddhist texts on psychological and philosophical texts of Buddhism, agree that as a factor determining the nature of the next rebirth, a weighty karma, whether healthy or unhealthy, invariably takes precedence over death proximate and habitual karmas. So those two I just mentioned, your whole collective tendencies and the moment of death, those two are allegedly trumped by whatever weighty karma one has accumulated. And the healthy weighty karma comes through meditation. And the more years or lifetimes of meditation we do, then the more weight in our favor we have. And if there isn't any weighty karma, then it falls to those other two, death proximate and habitual. I think that's there are a couple more classifications, but we don't have time to go into those. One other thing about the three poisons. This is a kind of just a general way of talking about human defilements, our unwholesome passions, our tendencies. And there is an ancient imagery for these three that will figure into the ceremony on Saturday. And these three, greed, ill will, and delusion, the symbol for greed or craving is a cock or a rooster. The symbol for hatred or ill will, anger, is a snake. And that for delusion or confusion is a pig. And for this great Jukai that we have every 3 years, in our approach to the Buddha Hall for the ceremony on Saturday afternoon, we're handed a little slip of paper that has these three animals biting their one another's tails in a circle, and we carry this through the six realms of unenlightened existence tunnel on up into the Buddha Hall, and then it gets a little later in the ceremony. There's a kind of a ceremonial burning of this to signify the purification of all of this negative karma that we have. For people who can't relate to rituals or ceremonies, let me just say briefly that all of this is by way of getting these things into our bodies. It's one thing to read about or to think about these things. It's something else to really enact these things. And these are little rituals that have been handed down to us from hundreds of years ago, that they're not magic, but they maybe, for some people, make it a little more meaningful, a little more real by, you know, actually taking in your hand this piece of paper and then depositing it at the altar and then having it, seeing it go up in flames. I think that's the point of all ritual and all ceremony, is to enact it and embody it rather than just with one's conceptual mind read about it or talk about it. So there is, there are just some basic points about karma. I think they certainly match what I've always heard or thought about, but karma as a doctrine. But now, let's go back to our case, the koan, and see if we can take it beyond doctrine. Zen, of course, has always been known as a teaching outside the scriptures, beyond the scriptures, outside words and concepts. And that's the point of koans, is that even though they are presented as stories or dialogues, our job in understanding a koan is to see beyond the words and the concepts. So, in this big monastery, it must have been big, if the great Baijiang or Hyakujo was the abbot of it. One day, after Taisho, everyone left except for this one guy. And apparently Hyakujo didn't recognize him because he asked him, who are you? And the man then replied, I'm not a human being. In the far distant past, I was the head of this monastery. I was the former abbot. And then I was asked by a certain monk once whether an enlightened person could fall again under the chain of cause and effect, whether the enlightened person is subject to karma. And I answered that he could not. And because of this answer, I have for 500 lives been reborn a fox. The choice of the animal fox is not, there's a reason behind that. The fox is regarded in China and Japan as a not just wily, but kind of a sneaky or deceptive animal, sort of symbol of that, those qualities. It's a little more complicated, though, because sometimes, actually, in another koan or two, the fox can be understood in the opposite way. So it has this dual nature, the fox, in Chinese and Japanese culture. But here, certainly we can see it as a rebirth that's not desirable. And so this man, or this fox who's standing there looking like a man, says, now please can you release me from this karmic retribution of 500 lives as an animal, and answer, can an enlightened person fall again under the chain of cause and effect or not? And then Hyakujo's answer was different than this former abbot had said. The former abbot had said, he does not. Simply, he does not fall under the chain of cause and effect. Hyakujo said he does not ignore the law of causation. There are a couple other translations of this key line, the koan. Aitken Roshi, in his version, has it as, he does not evade the law of causation. And Andy Ferguson, in his book, says, he is not blind to the law of causation. This is one of the very difficult things about translating from the Chinese, it seems, that it's a very imprecise language, written language, and you see all kinds of widely varying translations. These aren't so widely varying, but I mention them. I mention all three because doing so can sometimes help one get a sense of the spirit of it better. Sort of like in surveying, there is this process called triangulation. So if you have two or three different translations of the same line, it can help sometimes to get more of a sense of it. He does not ignore, he does not evade the law of causation, he's not blind to the law of causation. And this is the nub of the koan. The whole koan revolves around this line, and this is the line that one has to demonstrate in Doksan. That is one's understanding of it. And for people who are new to Zen, this is what is so hard about working on koans, is you have to present your understanding not as an explanation, but as a living, active presentation. Now, many demonstrations are verbal demonstrations, but they're not explanations. You can demonstrate with words, with some koans, but they can't be dry explanations. They have to be. You have to bring to life your understanding of that. So then, after this response, the old man was awakened and asked for this, asked to be buried on the other side of the mountain as a monk, given the rites of a funeral rites of a monk, and then the rest, where they go and find the body and they cremate it. It's not an important part of the koan. And then there's the scene shifts to that evening when Hyakujo takes his seat on the tan and tells the monks the whole story. And then his most senior disciple, Huangpo Obaku, asked a question. You see him raising his hand. And he says, okay, so this old man answered incorrectly and suffered rebirth as a fox for 500 lives. But suppose every time he answered, he had not made a mistake. What would he have become? Here the challenge for the student working on this koan is to understand what Obaku is up to here. He's laying a trap. What is it? Well, we can have our best chance of understanding it from what then transpires. Hyakujo, the master, without answering directly, says, just come closer and I'll tell you. So Obaku goes up and slaps Hyakujo, to which Hyakujo claps his hands and says, ah, I thought the barbarian's beard is red, but I see that you are a barbarian with a red beard. It's more elusive language that the student has to get the spirit of. It's definitely not the hardest part of the koan. And then the commentary. Mumon says, and this is in quotation marks, not falling under the law of cause and effect. Why was he turned into a fox? And then again in quotation marks, not ignoring the law of causation. Why was he released from a fox body? If in regard to this you have the one eye to see into this, you will know that the former head of the monastery did enjoy his 500 lives as a fox. The koan really speaks to how we live our lives, which is the whole point in Zen. To what degree do we enter fully into the circumstances and the conditions of our lives, which reflect our karma? You know, the circumstances and conditions are not accidental. We find ourselves in these in accordance with our karma. And then how do we deal with our karma, whether it's favorable or unfavorable or just neutral? Well, the key thing is not to separate ourselves from it. And we don't use the word sin in Zen. The closest thing to it is separation, not being one with, not concurring with, not moving along with, but setting ourselves apart from, and trying to squirm out of it, trying to escape it in some way, trying to avoid it. This is dukkha, the first of the four noble truths, which can be summarized as wanting to change what can't be changed, wanting to have what we can't have, wanting to relate in a way we can't relate. It's, in other words, it's wanting something other than what is. This, right here. Wishing it were different, wishing we were different, wishing other people were different, wishing our job was different, our family situation, our practice, wishing our practice were different, our Zen practice, wishing our appearance, our bodies were different, our minds, our abilities were different, wishing we had more. Wanting this, not liking that. This is the torment of the human condition, caught between our desires and our aversions. Very simple, basic, broad understanding of the human predicament. Caught between what we like and what we don't like, what we want and what we don't want. Instead of just throwing ourselves into that which can't be changed. The serenity prayer really is right at the heart of this koan. God, give me the serenity to accept what can't be changed, the courage to change what can be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference. Finally, the verse. Not falling, not ignoring. Two faces, but one die. Not ignoring, not falling. Hundreds and thousands of regrets. Not falling, not ignoring. Two faces, but one die. Die here is the singular form of dice. Two faces, but one die. These are all concepts. Not ignoring, not evading, not falling, not this, not that. Zen is always demanding that we get beyond the concepts of it. And live it. Respond to the challenge of change. So much of the challenge of life is change, dealing with change. We can't say that we can't just say that the enlightened person is not subject to cause and effect. Bodhidharma famously said, One who thinks only that everything is void, but is ignorant of the law of causation, falls into everlasting pitch black hell. This is what you wish that these rogue Zen teachers and Tibetan Buddhist teachers would take to heart when they make the claim that they're beyond it. They're not subject to causation. This week, 3 days ago, I was contacted by a woman who got involved with a Zen teacher. That is, a guy who claims to be a Zen teacher, set himself up as a Zen teacher without any kind of credentials, and who still, at the age of 74, is seducing his female students. And what she said, what he told her was that once, and she referred to this koan, Hyakujō no Fox, that he said with respect to that, once you've seen through right and wrong, good and bad, you can do anything you want. Well, take that up with Bodhidharma. And yet, is there no difference after awakening with these matters of right and wrong? True awakening means we've seen through these as mental constructs. And everything in our actions, in our words, in our thoughts depends on the understanding, the spirit behind it. A very highly esteemed Tibetan Lama, Rinpoche, gave a talk, public talk once. He's since died, but he gave a talk out in Hawaii in which the local Zen group attended with a lot of other people. And during the question period, one of the members of the Zen group asked him this question: does the enlightened person fall under the chain of cause and effect or not? And this enlightened Rinpoche said he does not. Is he then to be reborn as a fox or suffer karmic retribution for that answer? It's not so simple. It's not in the words. It's the understanding behind the words. It's the same with one's actions. But then you get into very dangerous territory if, with teachers like this guy I just mentioned, the 74-year-old guy, claiming that because they've had, allegedly had enlightenment, that they can do anything they want. Well, we'll get more into this in the Teisho on Saturday morning, but our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.